It is Sunday, December 2nd, 1984. I have with me, at the home of Jack and Betty Klein, a group of Players Club alumni who will be talking about the history of the club from the years 1916 to 1926. The first voice you will hear is that of the late Professor F.G.C. Wood, known to all as Freddie.
Early days of the Players Club. 5 weeks after UBC opened, on September 30th, 1915, the Players Club was formed. It was first suggested in an upper year class in English drama and seemed a good form of recreation for some of the leading man, a member of the senior class, played with a fine dignity and a surprising mellowness for a boy of 16 years. The next morning, President Westbrook suggested a repeat performance after examinations to be followed by one in Victoria and in New Westminster. In this way, the tour was born. And the proceeds of all performances donated to the University Red Cross Society and to the recreational activities of the UBC section of the 196th Western University Battalion, spending that summer in tents on the Fairview campus before going overseas. In the next 4 years, the club was able to earn over $6,000 for various patriotic purposes. In 1920, the inclusion of Nanaimo, Kamloops, and three Okanagan towns increased the number of performances to 10. 2 years later, the Kootenays were invaded, and by 1931, the last year under the founder's direction, the spring play, Noel Coward's The Young Idea, achieved the record number of 25 performances. During this period, the club appeared in some 27 towns and cities, including five on Vancouver Island, and others as far east as Revelstoke and Fernie. In many communities, these visits were the only chance many people had to see a production acted by others than members of a local organization, as plays by Barry, Weil, Pinero, A.A. Millen, and two by Shaw, as well as two by eminent Spanish dramatists, were among those presented. The varsity actors were a welcome change. Local organizations such as Kiwanis Clubs, chapters of the IODE, Women's Church Auxiliaries, and other groups were most helpful as sponsors, sharing in the proceeds of the performances. These contacts resulted in a growing interest in the university, and introduced the actors to sections of their province hitherto unfamiliar to them. Very occasionally, the play met with objection. In one Kootenay town, where the club was always most cordially received, an editorial appeared in the weekly paper. The play was Shaw's Pygmalion, and the long denunciation is summed up in the following excerpt. Such a production might be excusable in a third or fourth class Bowery theater, but to have the gutter snipe language of Lower London flaunted from the stage in the name of art by a group of university players passeth understanding.
That was the voice of the late Frederick Wood. The next speaker is our chairman, Professor Harry Warren.
One of the objectives of the UBC Alumni Association is to ensure that the history of our university is recorded, preserved, and communicated for the benefit of alumni, faculty, and students. To this end, it was decided to put on record a few of the many achievements of those faculty and students who were the pioneers of our university. To begin, this task was taken on by a committee named the Fairview Committee, drawn from the classes of 16 to 1926, the 26th class being the first to graduate from Point Grey. One of the many projects undertaken by the Fairview Committee was the reintroduction of the Arts 20 relay race, which was highly successful both in achieving memories of the past and drawing favorable attention to the university. Incidentally, 7 teams ran in the first race. The last one was 180 entrants and 170 teams finished. From the Fairview Committee emerged the Heritage Committee, committed with a much broader mandate and charged with dealing separately with later periods of the university's history. One of the more notable achievements of the university in its early days was the success of the Players Club under the inspirational guidance of the late Professor F.G.C. Wood. He has told you in his own words how it all began. As you have just heard, it was under the inspiration and guidance of Professor F.G.C. Wood, Freddie behind his back, and who his large number of friends, that the Players Club of the University of British Columbia came into being. Freddie, with the help of a chosen few, chose the plays that were to be shown in Vancouver and in some 25 to 30 centers in our province. He selected each cast, performed the role of director, producer, and in effect acted as business manager. Membership in the Players Club was by competition. The tryouts were an ordeal. Many tried out, but only 60 were chosen to become members of the Players Club in each year. Not only was the Players Club self-supporting, but thanks to the masterly managing of Freddie, it was, even in its early years, able to contribute many thousands of dollars to worthy charities. Of the 20 or so survivors of that early era, we have been able to make contact with a dozen, and it is from some of these that you will now be hearing, either in person or in proxy. Now, turning over to the stage manager, Sidney Risk.
Thank you. We're now going to hear reports on the first 11 spring plays from 1916 to 1926 inclusive. Comments were invited from members of the casts of these plays, and we've received comments from several members who were in the plays. The first play was 1916, Fanny and the Servant Problem, and we received comments from Jesse Todd Hunterfoot and Connie Highmore Adams. The second play was Merely Mary Ann, comments received from Helen Brody Whitmore and also Connie Highmore. 1918, Alice Sit by the Fire, again Connie Adams. 1919, The Importance of Being Earnest, Connie Adams again, and also Doro Adams, from whom we did not receive comments, but a little later, Jack Klein is going to speak of Doro. And 1920, Green Stockings. Now, as none of these ladies can be present today, I'm calling upon B. Wood to read their comments for us.
The first leading lady was Jessie Todd Hunter Tainter Foot in Fanny and the Servant. She played Fanny in Fanny and the Servant Problem. And all she says is, I wrote in a scene in Fanny and the Servant Problem at the request of Frederick Wood, and I made painted poster for the play. Now the second, as you have heard, it was Mrs. Cecil Adams, Connie Heimer, who was in four spring plays. She says, I was a charter member of the Players Club and remember attending the first meeting that Freddie Wood called in the fall of 1915 for any students who might be interested in a dramatic society. I was a member of the cast of four spring plays and president in my senior year. In that capacity, I wrote an article for the Theatre Magazine, published in New York, which appeared in the December 1918 issue. The title of the article is Dramatics at the University of British Columbia. I wonder if that article is in the archives of the Players Club history. One of the funniest things I remember was of the dress rehearsal of Alice Sit by the Fire, when the player acting Steve Rollo, I think his name was James Ellard, who was supposed to say, "I am utterly puzzled," burst out with, "I am putterly uzzled." The next leading lady was Helena Whitman, Helena Bodie, March 18, who played Marianne in Merely Marianne in 1917. I remember the character Marianne. She worked for a nice young man who called her Marion. The play was presented in the Empress Theatre downtown. We went on tour to Victoria. Freddie was the manager and director. At the end of the play, there were bouquets, one in particular from an American admirer who was a year ahead of me at UBC. I walked over the Fairview Bridge with him when he took me out. "Re Freddie Wood," she says. "We all liked him so much." Well, that is all for 20, up to 20.
The next three spring plays, 1921, 22, and 23. 1921, Sweet Lavender, and we have present Muriel Evans McDougall and Jack Klein. I would ask them to occupy seats up here, please, for your comments. Mr. Pym passes by in 1922. Betty, will you please come forward as well? And Neil McCallum and Georgina McKinnon, who are not with us, and Harry Warren and B. Wood will read their comments for us. The 1923 spring play was You Never Can Tell, again with Jack Klein, Betty Somerset Klein, B. Wood, and Neil McCallum. Will you please lead off, Muriel, with your comments?
Sweet Lavender. We had a high good time, went on tour with Sweet Lavender, and I do remember one happening, though I know there were many more. Kirstie Leveson had the part of Mrs. Gilfillian, I think that's right, and in one performance spent most of Act Two scurrying around clutching her stomach, and it turned out that her skirt had come undone at the back and she had to hold it up as well as she could, and she did a good job and just looked a little odd.
Weren't there a lot of other people in that cast that you two can talk about? Jack, who were you?
I was Mr. Moore.
What kind of Moore?
I was a lawyer. An English solicitor. And Art Lord was in it, and then, of course,
Lacey Fisher
and the chap, the hero.
Garrett Livingston.
Yeah, Garrett Livingston.
Garrett Livingston, yes.
And you were Sweet Lavender.
Yes, I was.
And I thought you were sweet at the time, and I still do.
Thank you so much.
Well, we had a lot of fun with that.
Could you carry on with the, you were also in Mr. Pym, and you were in You Never Can Tell. So, as you're here.
You want me to talk about what, one, any one of them?
Whatever you prefer. 1922 was Mr. Pym.
Mr. Pym,
yes.
And Neil McCallum was in that, and
yes.
Then You Never Can Tell. I think it was in the in You Never Can Tell that we arrived in Nelson. Was it You Never Can Tell, or was it Mr. Pym?
Mr. Pym, I think.
Well, in any event, Wells Coates, Bob Hunter, and Neil McKinnon and I went out on an advertising basis. We arrived in Nelson the night before the play was to go on, and found that there were practically no seats sold, which we found rather embarrassing. So the next morning we decided that we would carry a sign around the town advertising the play, which we did. And we carried it in line. I had to go first because they said I was the leading man. And we eventually, when we played that night, the house was full. But that's one of the chief things I remember about Mr. Pym. But I think you had some story to tell, Betty, about You Never Can Tell.
There are more stories to tell about Mr. Pym.
All right, who's going to tell us?
This, I must stand up.
No.
This is a story that Betty and Jack both choose not to remember. But they told it, Betty told it to me, and I could not have invented it. Kirstine was in the cast. She was your aunt, wasn't she?
Yes.
Your favorite aunt.
Yes.
Yes. And Kirstine and Betty shared a double bed, and Freddie used to put the women on one floor, and the boys, the young men on one floor, and the girls on another floor.
You're wrong.
But he didn't like the mixing. But anyway.
You're wrong.
No, you're right.
You're wrong. It was B. Wood and me.
No, it's another story. I'm not telling the same story you think of. That's another play. This is Mr. Pym Passes By. And I knew I'd have a family fight. But anyway, the gentleman in the party conveyed to you and Kirstine that it was just ridiculous, this segregation of the sexes, and we also have to have a letter from you, Harry, before we pass on. And they intimated that after the show was over, they would call upon Kirstine and Betty. So this is the picture that Betty described to me. She denies it, and Jack denies it, but I couldn't have invented it. Here were the two girls in bed, and a discreet knock on the door, and up came three men, Jack Klein, Wells Coates, and maybe it was Bob Hunter. And Bob Hunter and Wells, they had coats or dressing gowns, I've forgotten which, but Betty described Jack as coming up with a blanket over him in Indian fashion. And the two girls lay flat in bed with their blankets up to their chins. And the men came in, and they all tried to be very debonair, you know, sophisticated. And Betty said it was not at all successful. The gentleman felt rather sheepish. And persiflage was not possible under the tension of the moment, and the visit was quite brief. So that I remember. It was told to me. I couldn't have invented it. Audience, could I have invented it?
No, of course.
Now, Harry has a letter about Pym, too.
But I want to point out, though, that when we were on all those tours, that we always had a chaperone.
Yeah, Mrs. Yes. Madam Sutty.
Madam Sutty. Madam Sutty. You're quite wrong, Dorothy, about the question of the males being against the segregation. I was all in favor of the segregation.
Well, no. Betty Klein, you were in...
Wait a minute, we haven't heard...
It's
going to come up.
But I think that Betty should now have a chance, possibly, to give her version of these stories you've been hearing. Betty, you were in Mr. Pym Passes By, you're in You Never Can Tell, and you were in The World and His Wife. Now, could we hear your comments, please?
Well, the one that's the most dramatic is the World and His Wife in Grand Forks.
It was in Grand Forks, Betty. Mm-hmm. Terribly hot.
Terribly hot. And it was The World and His Wife, was it?
Yes, yes.
And at one moment in the play, somebody got up, marched out, clump, clump, yeah. Clump.
Did they do that in The World and His Wife?
No, I don't believe in The World and His Wife.
No, I think we're getting mixed. Uh-huh.
Which was it? It was in...
Let's go back to the play.
Mr. Pym Passes By, and You Never Can Tell.
Well, Mr. Pym Passes By was the first tour, I think,
that you went on.
That I went on, and maybe that Freddie had. And a grand, marvelous time for young people. spring, sun shining, flowers out in the Okanagan lakes. And it was quite a wonderful occasion. And a boat that went down the middle of the lakes and had an onion for lunch every day, I remember. And and it was really great fun and great pleasure for students. It was a great privilege, really, to be on these tours. And things changed when the car took us on instead of the boat, which was such fun. But I don't know what other incident to tell you of. What other incident, Jack, am I losing out?
Well, you remember the startling incident in Penticton.
That's the next play.
That is the next. What play is Betty talking about?
Mr. Pym.
She's talking about Mr. Pym.
Mr. Pym.
Oh, there, yes.
But the incident you have in mind occurred in the next production.
Oh, yes.
Which was, you never can tell.
You never can tell, yes. Right.
I thought you had a letter to read, haven't you?
Yes, from Elson. Georgina Elson. Georgina McKinnon Elson.
Pete McKinnon.
Who's in...
that's what we call her.
Mr. Pym.
Mr. Pym. She says, I had played the wife in the Christmas plays in Eugene O'Neill's one-act play, Isle. And it was such a success, I think Freddie rewarded me by letting me be in the spring play. Although it was 62 years ago, I remember my entrance greeting to Mr. Pym. I'm Dinah, not Diana, Dinah with an H. The spring tours from the Victoria to Nelson must have helped sell the university. Look at it now. I can't resist adding that our tour was enlivened by a noticeable rivalry for the attention of the leading lady, then Betty Somerset.
Oh.
Now, B, you
have no recollection.
You were in You Never Can Tell. So would you like to read your own comments with regard to that play, please?
Yes, I played Mrs. Clandon, the mother. One of my most vivid memories of tour was in the dining car when Freddie would allot us each $1 for a meal.
Yes.
Anything extra one had to pay out of one's own pocket. In those days, we were all very circumspect and called one another Miss and Mister. However, it was Freddie behind his back. Eloise Angel, who had more nerve than the rest of us put together, would call out the length of the dining car, Uncle Freddie, I can't get a proper meal for a dollar. Whereupon all eyes were turned upon the cruel uncle who was starving his miserable niece.
Now, Jack has already referred to Neil McCallum, who is in Mr. Pym Passes By and You Never Can Tell. Neil McCallum responded to our request with a very interesting letter. As he's not here, I shall ask Harry Warren to read that letter to us, please.
Well, I think the whole letter is a little long, but there are one or two parts that I think deserve to be quoted. And he writes, I remember the delightful trips on the old CPR sternwheelers on the Okanagan, Arrow, and Kootenai Lakes, especially the overnight trip from Kootenai Landing to Nelson. I can remember dear Mrs. Sutty, who was so kind and helpful to us all. What he didn't say was that men had a great crush on Mrs. Sutty because she ate like a bird, and any of us who were lucky enough to sit at her table could have her, part of her meal as well as their own, and thereby carry on through the trip. Another thing that I think some of you would be amused, I remember at a party after the show in Cranbrook, Freddie telling the hostess that when we played Creston, that some of the cast had to be billeted out as the hotel was not fit to stay in. Having lived in that country as a boy, I was able to tell him, much to his chagrin, that the owner of the hotel in Creston was the brother of our Cranbrook hostess.
Thank you, Harry.
There's more to it, I think.
Jack, you...
Isn't there more to that, Harry?
Well, there's a long letter, but I think these are the... Well...
Oh, go ahead and read.
You have time.
Well, here's a little bit. A funny thing happened to me on the way to the incinerator. I was about to burn a lot of old stuff, including an old photo album, when your letter arrived in the mail. So I salvaged a few snapshots, which I thought might be of interest to you, unless you already have copies of these in the archives. I have many fond memories of the spring tours of 22 and 23, but I seem to remember more about Mr. Pym tour than about You Never Can Tell, perhaps because the cast was much smaller, but in any case, I think we had more fun. And he, as a little addition to what has just been said, I can remember Freddie standing at the door of the dining car on the train, telling each of us as we entered for lunch, not more than 25 cents. Someone has just said a dollar.
Oh, a dollar was for dinner.
Yes.
$0.25
I remember an impromptu concert we put on for the patients at Tranquil on the afternoon of the night we played Kamloops. Jack Klein and I did a Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Sheen skit, which was bloody awful. I think that's...
Jack, you have some comments. I think you'd like to refer to Doro Adams. Doro was a distinguished leading lady in the Players Club. She played in The Importance of Being Earnest in 1919 and in Green Stockings in 1920. We have not received any comments from her, but I personally, but I think that Jack may bring her to mind for us.
Of course, Doro went on to have a very distinguished theatrical career. All I think I mentioned was that I was sorry that we didn't hear from her, but I did see her 2 years ago in Los Angeles at a meeting of the alumni in Los Angeles, the UBC alumni. We went down there to spread the good word in those days. I was chancellor, and we had a very, very pleasant party at the house, I think, of the Canadian consul. And Doro was there and was in very good spirits and looking extremely well. And I'm sorry she's not here this afternoon.
Yes. Thank you, Jack.
May I just interpose here for a minute? Talking about Doro and Sweet Lavender, it makes me think of some of the other women in the cast. Kirstine, mm-hmm. Marjorie Agnew, mm-hmm. Doro, Kirstine, Marjorie Agnew, you, Muriel. Was there any other woman?
Yeah, who was it?
Bruce. And then do you remember Bruce Fraser?
Yes, he was in Sweet Lavender.
That was in Sweet Lavender, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Kirby.
Yeah.
All these names,
yeah.
But I think particularly of those women.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The four women.
Mm-hmm.
Kirby, is he the lawyer?
He was a lawyer, yes.
He's the one.
We didn't need to go into that.
Well, now this brings us to our short intermission.
Betty should start it and Bea finish it.
Right.
Well, in Penticton, we were tired out. We'd had a long week performing late at night and so on. And we went to bed, and
who's we?
Bea and I. Bea got on the inside of the bed, and I was on the outside of the bed. And right off to sleep. We were exhausted, really. And I woke up, and it was such a strange feeling of being awakened, and couldn't understand it, and looked down to the end of the bed, to the window, to see if it was morning, but it wasn't, it was black. So then I thought, that's queer, and I looked up at the transom, into the face of a young man about this far away. And so I screamed, but not without grabbing Bea, you see, who was obviously...
Save Bea.
So I grabbed her, and Bea came to, and in a contralto scream, she said, is he coming or going? and the door opened across the way, and it was Mr. Petullo. And by this time, our friend had disappeared, and Eloise Angel, who was in the room next door, had come in to take charge of things. And there was a cigarette butt on the floor, and so she picked that up. It was very, very significant. And then she went out the hall, and next door to us was a little corridor with the bathroom and the other thing down there. And she went, and there was no light on anywhere, but it was locked.
Yes.
And so this was a grave concern. And so by this time, the night watchman came around, and we told him all this. And he went up and got the landlady, who was running the hotel, somewhat under the influence of liquor.
The landlady was the under the influence
of liquor. So she came down and heard our story, and which we told of the fact that the man had on a khaki coat and a check cap, and we were very indignant about the whole thing. And he went next door and he found the chappie in the toilet or the bathroom, and he brought him in, and he stood in the doorway. Well, he looked just a young man. And well, we never did really find out anything about that. But meanwhile, Mr. Patullo, who was in the room across the hall.
This is Duff Patullo, the premier.
Yeah, the premier. Yes, there was a liberal convention on.
Oh, that's it.
Yes. Liberal bells.
He opened his door just a little to hear all this, you see. Well, the next day, word went around the hotel, if you have a check coat and a khaki cap, don't wear it.
Oh, no. Being you were in this cast, have you anything to add to this story?
Well, all I can say was they got after me at the end, because all I did was leap out of bed and say, my God, where is he?
I would like to ask, did you two ladies feel that the gentlemen in your party were really concerned for you? Did they?
When they were upstairs.
Were they galant? I mean, the next day, did they try to follow it up and just
the next day,
protect your honor
were,
or anything?
Not at the same floor, because Freddie didn't think it was wise to put the women on.
No, they had to be on another floor.
So he put them on another floor. And, no, we didn't feel they were sufficiently concerned. And to this day, Jack, what did you do? Anything about it?
Well, we went around.
What could you do?
We went around and looked for somebody with a
check cap,
but we couldn't find them. And of course, Freddie was quite right in putting the men and the women on different floors, because the men had to be protected.
I want to ask a question here, and I'm going to put Sydney on the spot. Penticton, the Incola Hotel, fascinates me, because so many things have happened there.
Yes.
The near rape of you two.
oh, gracious. Well,
and the other story that you were telling. Now, Sydney, when he was director of the Players Club, he went on tour, I don't know with which play, and you were the director of the club and in charge of it, and you were up at the Incola Hotel, and some of your men cast, went swimming in the buff.
No.
Do you remember that story?
Yes.
Are you going to tell it?
Tell it.
That belongs to another generation, doesn't it?
I know it does, but I thought...
That was much later, Dorothy, the spring play, Alibi of 1933. And it's quite true, certain members, I won't mention their names, did go in the buff in the lake. And certain other members of the cast thought that... good idea to just take their clothes, which were left on the beach, which they did. And there was consternation, some screaming and yelling going on. And the upshot of it all was the three gentlemen in the lake had to come out, and they braved it. In the nude, they dashed to the lobby of the Incola to the amazement of Des Clark, another Jesse there, and up to their rooms. I had to put up with them. Rather severe lecture from the assistant manager the next day about the behavior of certain members of the cast. That's that.
It's the Penticton link that fascinates me.
Yes.
Oh, well, if it's all the stories, it's the story B up at Fernie. And Fernie, well, we weren't too fond of Fernie. The bedspreads weren't clean, but the sheets were. But in any case, we were having lunch, and B was trying to get some ketchup out of the bottle, and somebody asked for something, and the landlady said, oh, well, we're out of that. And B said, well, you'll never be out of tomato ketchup. And they were mad that they ever wanted us to come back.
Didn't they complain to Freddie?
Yes.
Oh, yes. The proprietor of the restaurant said that he would not go to the Players Club again.
Oh,
well.
He would not see another performance.
So that's out.
And the next day, I got a lecture from Mr. Klein and Mr. McCollum for my bad behavior.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Absolutely. Oh, it was funny.
Now, if we have no further comments on these particular plays, we'll take a short break if you'd like to stretch your leg. Now we come to the last three spring plays on our program for this afternoon. 1924, The World and His Wife. 1925, You and I. 1926, Pygmalion. Now, we've received a number of comments on these plays. I would like to ask Kenneth, would you come forward, please? Take your seat up here. And Avis, also. And Mildred. There.
Rose between two thorns.
Yes. Now, in the World and His Wife, Kenneth Capel and Avis Pumphrey and Betty Somerset, you should be up here too, dear. Another chair required.
Yes.
Oh, don't go ahead.
No.
Better if you sit closer, Betty.
Come over here.
The mic.
Oh, well, we can do it this way, Betty. The moving situation.
Kenneth, you were also in The World and His Wife and You and I, and you have some comments of your own to make. I'd like you to lead off with them, please.
Well, the spring plays at the university were something rather special, and of course, I was an agricultural student, and we were over on Broadway, which is four or five blocks from the university, and the students at the university were considered outsiders. And when we got into the play, it was sort of surprising. Why would they bring an agricultural student into something cultural? But I tried out. I was in the spring play, at least a Christmas play of 1921, The Maker of Dreams, which I was a Pierrot. And then when I tried again for a spring play in 1924, Freddie, who was a most distinguished and gentle fellow, who told you the facts of life, but he did it gently, and he said, we'll take you on as an understudy because you might be useful, you never know. So I traveled all over the province with the spring tour in 1924. The only thing that I did in the way of a cultural contribution was I was a voice off stage. And the other times I carried the ladies' baggage, was charming to the young ladies, at least I think that was my biased opinion, and moved scenery, got up first in the morning to make sure that things were done, went to bed last at night still making sure that everything was under control. And Freddie, the distinguished gentleman he was, didn't ever praise me, but he gently patted me on the back and said, keep going, Capel, keep going. So then in 1925, I got a part in the play, which was to me very exciting because I was the young lover. And some of my friends in agriculture said, hell, Capel, you don't know anything about love. Why did they choose you? But anyway, it was a delightful experience. And when we traveled all over the province and played in, I don't know matter how, 25 or 26 towns, Freddie made us feel very much that we were representing the University of British Columbia. And while he never said this, he made us feel that, you know, many of these people don't know what the university is, so you have to portray to them the possibilities of a university. So on stage and off stage, we did our duty. We thought we did our duty. But it was a great experience and great fun. And we played the play, went after the play to a reception where people were in the community were very gracious to us, gave us tea and three cookies and a sandwich. And then we went home, got to bed, and then got up early in the morning, made sure everything was packed up tight, ran like the devil to whatever the transportation was, went on to the next town, got there, unloaded the stuff, went to the theater, set up the scenery, looked things over. I think we had a bath, and then we behaved ourselves. Usually, they entertained us and gave us a tea and three cookies, and then we went back, had supper, and Freddie made us be at the theater at 6:30 to be ready, polished and distinguished, to do a polished and distinguished act. And so it was a marvelous experience, a great team, a great fun, and we went around the province, and to me it was the first time I had been in many of these communities. We didn't bathe nude, as somebody mentioned earlier, but we did bathe. But altogether, as a student of agriculture, mainly horticulture, it was an amazing experience to meet all these cultural people. For a farmer, I got a new insight on the other side of Canadian life.
Thank you, Kenneth. Now, Avis, you were in these three plays, The World and His Wife, You and I, and Pygmalion. Now, you have surely something you want to say about all that.
Well, I was going to say I was only partially in The World and His Wife. I was only for part of the tour because I had a very exciting part of a maid, and I think all I said was dinner is served or something like that. And my important experience was that I was the props. I had to check to see that everything that was needed on the stage was on the stage. And the main thing that I can remember about The World and His Wife was going to Britannia Mines. And we went by boat, and then we got into the ore buckets. And we're taken at a most precarious angle right up the mountain to the mines. And this was very exciting, and the men were allowed to go into the mines to see them, but it was unlucky to allow women to, so we weren't allowed in. And we felt, I still feel badly about that.
When we came down and were waiting on the dock at Britannia Mines, the men of the cast played a very sporting and stimulating game, Kick the Can.
Right.
Yes.
Right. It showed how cultural they were.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yes, yes. That's all I can remember about The World and His Wife. I can remember a lot more about You and I.
Yes.
Well, I was low comedy, once more a maid, but very low comedy at that time. Wasn't it Peter Price who was the, wasn't he the, you were
yes.
the, you were the.
Peter Price was in You and I, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he was the man of the house who was the artist, wasn't
That's
he?
That's right, yes.
And he wanted a cheap model, so he took the maid, which was me.
Etta,
thank you, I forgot my name. And I was dressed up in a bright red dress, and Peter was to paint me. And then somebody, and I think it was you, Harry, were a visitor coming to the house who fell for this gorgeous maid, thinking she was a visitor. And I had to try to, you said, would I be free?
I'm sorry, I was a businessman.
Well,
I didn't wake up with Etta.
Didn't
I
you? Who did?
Admirer
who did?
Was.
I can't remember. Somebody did.
Yes,
anyway, whoever it was, I beg your pardon, Harry, whoever it was said to me, I could
going back in my memory, are you free at all to come out tonight? With great firmness, I said, Thursday afternoon. And then there was I wish I had the script of the play. Then there was a part where I was practicing saying goth in a very proper manner. Guff, goth, etc. In preparation to going up with this new boyfriend. But I really, I don't know about that. But I do remember getting back to this question of meals on the train. I insist that we had to have a partner. And we...
The tape over. Yes, green.
I don't remember how much money we were allowed, but I do recall that we had to have a partner.
Those were on the table with the soup.
We had to have a partner and have the embarrassing business of saying to the steward, we will have one order of this and two plates.
Yes.
And then if your partner was a man, he thought that he ought to have the larger plate. Half. The
yes.
Larger half. I do remember that very well.
With resentment, I expect.
I also remember a ridiculous thing that happened on the train with the you and I business. It was a rather dull piece of country, and we were getting rather tired of talking to each other, and we were dirty, and we were, you know, it was a long way to the next place we stopped. And somebody, was reading a magazine, and there was an article on palmistry. So I thought, oh, I think I'll read this very carefully, memorize the whole thing, and then I sat on it in case anybody should find it. And I said very innocently, by the way, did I ever tell you that I know about palmistry? Well, everybody sat up with delight. And no, they hadn't heard that. So I read their palms. And of course, by this time, I knew each of them very, very well. And I had a wonderful time. I told them all their faults and all their fine points, and I got a reputation that I sometimes comes back and hits me now, and I honestly admit I don't know anything whatever about palmistry, but it helped to pass the time.
Now, Avis, you were also in Pygmalion. Have you any recollections of that?
Well, I went from the ridiculous to the sublime in Pygmalion. Because I was no longer a maid. I was Clara Eynsford Hill. And very, very proper. And I recall that a bit of that, which was covered in that magazine newspaper editorial, that after what was her name? In Pygmalion, the main character?
Liza.
After Liza came out with one of her, you know, not bloody likelies.
Walk when they're taxis.
Not bloody likely.
Not bloody likely. That, I think it was after she had become refeigned, you know.
Reign in Spain.
Yes, after she'd become refeigned and she had been shown off to society. Then Clara Eynsford Hill, the splendid character that I was, said, oh, I think the new small talk is so frightfully funny, don't you think it is? Not bloody likely. Which was great fun. And then they wanted to cut it out because somebody, it must have been that person, thought that it was not quite nice. And we all said that we would retire from the cast immediately if they cut it out. I think I've run out of things that I remember.
Yes.
Oh, I do remember one thing, though. I'm sure you do, Kenny, too. The parties after the shows, they were in a church hall or a schoolroom or something, and they had chairs all around the outside, and we sat there. And everybody stared at us and were too shy to speak to us. And we were too shy to speak to them, as a rule, as we ate those three cookies and drank a cup of tea or coffee. It's dreadful the way they always had the chairs around there.
It's deadly, isn't it?
Deadly.
Now, Betty, you and Mildred were in The World and His Wife. Have you any further recollections you want to make?
Well, I do remember staying in the hotel in Grand Forks. Grand Forks, and word got about, well, Freddie was informed after we left that they regretted to tell him that a pillow was missing, and two of his students must have taken it, because Mildred and I were rooming together, and it was that room that the pillow was missing. And it turned out that the pillow was under the middle of the mattress, because we couldn't stand the mattress which came
rolled together. We were on the train. We'd gone from Grand Forks in the morning down to Christina Lake. Do you remember, for a picnic lunch? Somebody was by the name of Kirby. Was entertaining us at Christina Lake. And then we boarded the train, you know, somewhere out of Grand Forks, and we weren't on the train very long when Freddie got the telegram and came down looking like thunder and saying, what had Betty and I done taking it?
I didn't realize it was a telegram.
Yeah, he got a telegram.
Yes. How silly.
Well, I think there's a story that I should tell. In 1925, we were playing somewhere, I forget, in the southern part of British Columbia, maybe Cranbrook or somewhere. And I happened to be in a scene where I was on the backstage talking to a girl while the main actors were in the front of the stage. And they were carrying on, and we had to wait until our cue came, until we came forward, when another actor came in from the back and joined our group and told us something. And it so excited us that when my cue came, I didn't respond to my cue. Now, we played the play 25 times, and I stood at the back and didn't move, and then Freddie, who always used to stand at the side of the stage with the cue, say, step up, Capel, and so I stepped up and went on with the play, and then he said afterwards, listen, Capel, you've played this play 25 times, now why did you mess up that? But I said, sir, I don't think I can tell you. And he said, well, I'd like to know. Well, I said, I'm sorry. Well, what happened was this. The girl who came in, she had been given some mail that was held up at the hotel, and she opened it backstage. She got the news that Freddie was engaged to Bea Wood. And she came in, and the three of us in the back corner chatting, she said, do you know what? That old man is marrying that beautiful girl, Bea Wood. Whereupon I forgot my lines.
Quite right, too.
He said Bea Johnson.
He said Bea Johnson, I'm sure. Bea Johnson, we would have said, yeah.
Good story.
Dorothy was talking earlier about the Encola Hotel, and I can remember something that happened at the Encola Hotel which had to do with you and I. Because I think we were playing two nights there, and to my horror, I got laryngitis in the first performance, and I could hardly speak in a whisper.
Was that the play where you had one line?
Oh, no. That was the one where I was low comedy and an artist's model and stuff. No, so this time, a nice doctor came out of the audience afterwards, took me down to the kitchen of the Encola Hotel and got a steamer going and steamed my throat, bless his sweetheart, and then finally got me into bed, and the next day I was able to. Got me into bed. Oh, that does sound bad. It was very proper, I assure you.
So the morals of the young will not be interfered with. I think those lines should be eliminated.
I think so, too.
Let's leave them in.
Good. We make a note of that.
Now, also in You and I was Beachy Capel, and an old friend, B, you will come in, please.
Beachy Clegg Capel was on, that's 28, was she?
27.
She played the mother of Kenneth in You and I by Philip Barry. We all know of Beachy's present illness and regret that she can't be here to speak for herself,
yes,
give us some of her inimitable remarks. She was one of the bright lights in You and I and added greatly to the success of the play.
Thank you, B. Now, Pygmalion.
There's
the
a story there I think that's amusing. In the play You and I was a young troubadour in tights, very smart-looking tights, showed my legs off to the best advantage, and I had a ruffle around my neck and a harp, and I was going to go out to a party and sing, so I went to kiss my mother goodnight. Beachy was my mother in the play. This is when I first met Beachy. And I went to kiss her goodnight, and we used to have a little peck in the cheek and run, you see, but I pecked her in the cheek, and she held me like this, and she said, "Kiss me again." And I was a little startled and surprised, so I kissed her again. She said, "You fool, kiss me again." I said, "What's wrong?" She said, "You've got that damn banjo in my earring. Kiss me again." So I kept kissing her while she disengaged the banjo from her earring and her hairnet, and then she said, "Bugger off."
As I said, inimitable remarks.
Sydney, before you go to Pygmalion, there's one story that should go back to the world and his wife. Betty, your story in the Vancouver production.
Oh, yes, well, that was quite fascinating. We were shouting away because it was a great experience for us to try and talk in that theater after having talked at the University Theater and so on. And what's the name? Frieda Barclay was playing opposite me, and the two of us were having a scene in the front place, and her responses were very slow in coming back, and I couldn't understand it, and I'd give her the cue again and so on. And finally I realized that she was not well, and sort of pushed her up against the arm of the Chesterfield, so she'd have something to lean against, and went on, and suddenly a voice from above, a beautiful voice, came down, and it was Rand Kennedy.
Matheson.
Rand Kennedy and Wynne Matheson.
Mm-hmm.
And their box was practically over the stage, and he spoke down. He said, "Sit down, my dear, sit down." He was so calm and nice, and I managed to get her around to the Chesterfield where she could sit. And meanwhile, that damn Freddy didn't pull down the curtain, and because I thought she was going to faint right there. So did the audience. Her legs were going and so on.
Oh.
And, but however, she sat down, and she recovered and managed to finish the scene. And
well, if I may speak to that, because I was in the audience, and before ever you got her near the sofa, here was my sister facing front stage, a woman who was fainting. Her knees were just buckling, and she was leaning forward, and Betty Crowley would put her hand against her chest and shove her upright.
Show us.
You remember that? I do. And I thought, God, Betty. You know, and she'd sag again, and Betty'd shove her up. And then finally, because Rand Kennedy was the honorary president of the Players Club, wasn't he?
Yes, he was honorary.
And he saved the day, that gorgeous voice and his white head when you looked up there. But
Well, what did you want Betty to do with it?
Well, really? I don't know what I thought, but Betty just looked awful.
And
you know.
You
have a feeling she should have put her arm around her and done something protective. And who was talking about, you see, Freddie tried to, Mildred, you have a story, yes, about when stagehands can't be found?
Oh, well, you see, Avis and I shared the very, very demanding part of Maid in the world. I mean, if you only have one or two lines,
they're
very important.
Right.
And you make it or lose it, you see. in just one or two lines. So anyway, along with my bachelor's degree that year, I became an expert rummy player because there was a rummy game going. Seemed to me you were probably on stage full-time, Betty, but there were quite a few in that cast who didn't spend all their time on stage. So, but I was the key figure in the rummy game, and I kept it going. I learned that. And Kenneth, I think I was music off stage too, because I know I had to start a record always, and once we didn't get it going, or maybe we shared that. And then there were two minor rebellions on that tour. The first one occurred in Kamloops. We got there and found, again, as somebody else did some in Nelson, I think, that there were no seats sold. Very, very upsetting. And Freddie, very smartly, went out and either borrowed or rented a truck, an open truck, and insisted that all the males on the cast get in the truck and drive around town with a banner. And I know there were grumblings. They thought that as professional actors or semi-professional, it's beneath their dignity. And then there was a one-woman rebellion somewhere along the line. I don't know, it must have been the shirt that he wore on stage, but one of the actors, Pete Palmer, his stage shirt needed laundry, and he handed it to Betty to do. And Betty said she didn't want to wash any man's shirt who had a 17 size neck. You remember that, Betty? No. I don't think you were.
What did I spot?
He was your husband on stage, wasn't he?
Yes, I think he was.
I think he was. Don in that story.
Jack's only wears a 15 and a half.
Just kept under the wire.
Yes, well, now for Pygmalion. We had comments from several members of that cast. Isabel Barton Morrison, Grace Hope Stevenson, neither of whom are present, but we'll ask B to read their comments to us, please.
Well, this is what Isabel Barton Morrison of Arts 26 has to say.
She is Eliza.
1925-26. This was the year that UBC moved from Fairview to the Point Grey campus. Now the Players Club had a grand new auditorium for its performances. And what a wonderful stage. For the first act of Pygmalion, we actually had a taxi drive onto the stage to pick up Eliza. Also, rain was made to fall. I think Tommy Lee was responsible for a great deal of stage magic. Freddie Wood was our kindly, dedicated mentor, loved and respected by us all. One of my personal hilarious memories is of the late Darcy Marsh, who played Alfred Doolittle, trying to help me acquire a Cockney accent. That's Isabel. Now, should I read
yes, would you
Grace
please,
Hope
please?
Stevenson yes. of Arts 27 says, good, she played Mrs. Is it, Grace Hope Stevenson of Arts 27 played Mrs. Eynsford Hill in Pygmalion. Good to have a reminder of those halcyon days of the Players Club. I still have the photos that someone took on the spring tour with Pygmalion. Coming down in a launch from Britannia Beach, Avis Pumphrey, Darcy Marsh, looking very theatrical, Freddie Wood with hat on one side, posing. I remember that by the time we returned to Vancouver in June 1926, after 30 performances, we felt like professionals, ready to take on and do Seattle or anywhere else on the continent.
How true.
I have seen My Fair Lady and Pygmalion since, but none compared with our own version.
Now, another member of the cast was Willoughby Matthews.
Oh, yes.
And he has a brief comment here. I will just read it to you. The details of my own mind are now almost totally submerged in one glorious memory of wonderful friendships, adventure, and mild achievement. Now, another prominent member of that cast, Pygmalion, was our chairman this afternoon, Harry Warren. He's right here, and he can tell us something about
I think the most interesting thing that I can report was that Freddie was determined to have rain actually on the stage. I had to design a great canvas trough. So when the rain came down, the cast, after the rain had fallen, we'd muster it and carry it off and throw it off the side. We had no way of getting rid of it. The only place that Freddie capitulated was at Britannia. The stage was so small that he allowed, we pretended there was rain there. But Freddie was a very hard taskmaster over that rain business.
Harry, were you in charge of producing this rain?
I was in charge of producing the rain, and at Salmon Arm, when we got there, we found there was no standpiper anywhere by the theater. And the nearest one was two blocks away, one block down one way, one block the other way. So we had to get pipes from the citizens of place and then time how long it came from. I put my hand like this when the rain was to come, and the rain would come through, and about 2 minutes later the rain came. And then we had to make a signal for the rain to stop, you know. And it was quite exciting. But if I can say, it was quite an awful job, because we had to cart this thing in a huge crate everywhere we went. And I think the baggage people got very disgruntled about it all. We had another tragedy, or near tragedy, in Pygmalion. As you know, Peter Price was the leading man, and he had beautiful curly hair, which the girls loved to put their hands through. And Peter found this very embarrassing. And one of the leading ladies insisted on doing this, and Peter finally was very naughty. He picked her up, put her on the floor, picked her ankles up, and dragged her all around the hotel. Well, she was letting out squeaks and squeals, and the rest of us were horribly embarrassed and didn't know what to do about it. But no one, none of the women put their hands through his hair anymore. That was at Revelstoke. The hotel is now burnt down, I know.
Just think so.
Well,
did Harry play Colonel Pickering?
Yes.
I played Pickering.
You'd make a good
difference.
No,
that
brings
us close to our formal program, and I'm going to turn it back to our chairman for winding it up. Harry?
Well, one of two things are coming to mind. Freddie was always the soul of tactfulness, and I remember I wanted to try out for a part. I suppose it was a part Kenny got, and when I went in to Freddie to get the part, he looked at me and he said, "Do you know Miss Butt very well?" Oh, I said, "No, I tried out with her once, that's about all." Well, he said, "Perhaps you'd be wise to try for another part." I wasn't anxious to be put off, so I said, "No, I think I'd like to try out for this part." I took my part and went round the corner, and the first line, Dorothy heard to me, "Darling, you haven't kissed me yet." And of course, at that time, I was just paralyzed with fear. When the tryout came up in the old building, we were both of us so nervous that I fell flat on my face on the steps going up to the which I think lost me the part. I think that was why Kenny moved in and took the lead. Freddie has, I think I got in well with Freddie. I'm not sure. B may be able to correct this, but the tryouts, you used to have to pay $1 to try out, and a lot of the people didn't pay their $1. If they didn't get in, they just disappeared. And of course, I was the treasurer that year, with Elfrida Barclay was the president, and I started the system that they didn't go on for the tryout till they put their $1 in my hot hand. And I think Freddie found this was a very salutary way of collecting the dues for the Players Club. At any rate, Freddie and I remained great friends ever after.
Forgotten about them.
I'd like to make one comment. Avis, I think it was Avis, or was it you, Mildred, referring to the fact that you felt you were professionals, you know, and you'd been on the tour, I think it was you then, been on the tour of so many productions and done so well. We've been talking about the past here, which is what we have come to do, we wanted to talk about the Players Club and Freddie in those early years. I would like to just look at Freddie from the point of view of the future. This was in the 20s mostly, and then there's the Players Club in the 30s and the 40s. But the theatre in Canada, which of course is what Freddie cared about, the theatre above all, it was growing apace. And then the CBC came along and it had jobs for professional actors. And it was obvious that the world of professional theatre was going to come to Canada, going to come to Vancouver. And I'm thinking now of all the hurrah there was over the laying the cornerstone of the new Festival Theatre in London, in England, do you remember? Well, Freddie laid the cornerstone, I'm thinking of an actual occasion, of the professional theatre here from the university's point of view, because it was Freddie in 1945 himself who recommended that there should be credits within the English department for theatre, recognising the fact that with the Canadian theatre becoming more and more, offering more and more opportunities for professional theatres, that they would need the extra training. So that in a way, that motion that he made to Senate, which was seconded by Garnet Sedgwick, was the beginning of the university becoming involved in professional theatre. Mm-hmm. So that is an important mark, I think.
Yes. Yes. Sydney, I think we should all of us mention the fact that you, Sydney Risk, and Dorothy Somerset have carried on what Freddie started in the marvellous way. And I myself regret that the Players Club as such does not exist today. I as an engineer, Kenny as an Aggie, all sorts of uneducated people got some education. And while there's some marvellous performances in the theatre today, I don't think there are very many engineers or agricultural students, at least as far as I know, performing.
Well, there's one story I think I should tell. I don't remember which play this was in, but it was a play in which there were two beautiful people on this side of the stage and two dirty, scrubby thugs on that side of the stage and somebody up a pillar up here who was Wisdom. And
that's a little theatre, wasn't it?
It's a little theatre. A little theatre,
was it? Yes, yes. Simon's Stylites.
Yes, that's it.
Oh,
yes.
And I was playing the beautiful young man on this side for two rehearsals, and then they cast me on the other side is the dirty, in which I had to play naked, and I was dressed in cocoa, just nothing but cocoa, naked but cocoa. You know. And I complained about this change of casting, and I said, but I was playing that part of the beautiful person. But the director said, but don't you realize, Capel, that you're basically an earthy type? Oh. I gave up the theater. I've never played since.
Oh, I should think so.
Oh, it's a little theater, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a little theater, yes.
Yes. What about
audience
what?
Comments?
Yes.
It's the only time I was ever dressed in cocoa.
Tell us about
you.
Oh, you.
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
thank
we
you for
want to comment.
Oh, there's a comment right there.
No, may I speak first, dear? I never do anything without your permission.
Yes,
I wish to thank you for the privilege of having been able to sit here and listen. It was very nostalgic, at least. And I think it's the most important thing to do, because recently I've come across two or three things of interest which you cannot now find the history of. And there's no one to tell you anything about it. Now you've got a good record.
Yes.
And you can use that, and you're doing an important job, I guess, whoever started it should be congratulated. But apart from that, I've enjoyed myself, but I have nothing to contribute. Now I'll let you speak.
Well, as a matter of fact, various things came up, memories, particularly Betty.
holding up Elfrida and talking to her, holding her up and talking to her, and poor Elfrida's legs, and absolutely. And then you say that lovely voice that
yes,
came.
Yes.
You were in
and
the
also,
audience?
Also, it's just marvelous that Billy Brad brought back. He just appears the whole time, and we all have special memories of
yes,
Billy. Particularly once, Mildred, the Christmas play.
Will you tell the story, dear?
It was a Russian play, and I was Varvara. I've forgotten who you
yes,
were.
Yes, I've forgotten, too.
But
it
was a
woman.
It was a very dramatic Russian play.
The Little
play.
Stone House.
The Little Stone House was the name, and I've forgotten what part...
Tubby Shore was in it, and
oh.
Lloyd Edgett.
Yes.
Oh.
But who was it whose mustache...
Lloyd Edgett.
Lloyd, he was about to speak, and the mustache came off, and I caught Mildred's eye, and she caught mine, and the worst happened, uncontrollable. Uncontrollable giggles. At that moment, I had to go off stage to bring in an axe, I think it was. It was a prop, anyway. And I had to face Freddy, who grew taller and taller and taller and glared down more and more and more and said, I'll see you on Monday, and handed me the axe.
Where was this? How did you get
a Christmas play.
Oh,
a Christmas play. It was one of the worst moments, but man, it was funny, Mildred.
Are we off? Is the record still going?
Oh. Yes, this is a casual.
Well, Dorothy, may our stage manager, may I tell a story, which is Players Club alumni. When we put on Distant Point, you know, in the years that we loved the Russians, we put on Distant Point. I was playing, there were two incidents in that play. The first one, I was playing the part of an older peasant woman, and a young man was going off to war and leaving his sweetheart, and they were saying goodbye, but they were very stiff about it, and my line was, now go up and kiss Petchka goodbye decently. I can hardly say the line, and it came out, now go up and piss. Piss Petchka decently. And Dorothy, you were monitoring, you know, the book, and you didn't get it. You didn't know why we were all. And then the other thing that happened in Distant Point, there was a very important general played by Jack, what was it,
Jack? Jack Emmons.
Ammon, Jack Ammon. And as a sort of a bribe, I suppose, I don't know, or peace offering, I was to give him a brace of ducks that I... or geese that I'd shot that morning, and some sable skins for his wife. And the audience, on Monday night and Tuesday night, the audience had complained that the ducks really did, the geese looked like ordinary BC farm ducks. So they were put into, by Blair Bailey, the prop man, into a little sort of gunny sack with just the feet hanging out. And in the excitement of all this exchange, getting them in there, when I came to the line, and here are some sables for your wife, and I go into the pocket of this enormous skirt, the sables aren't there. Now, we had borrowed the sables from B. Wood. And who was in the theater that night? B. and Freddie Wood. And who was backstage almost before the curtain was down? Freddie, where are my, are B's sables? So that was not it. That was the Wednesday night, do you remember? And that play... I guess it was the only time the Players Club really lost money. We lost about $1,400, remember?
Wow.
Well, I'll tell you why. We had to have a musician on stage and to play a, it was kind of a folk instrument, and he was absolutely incompetent doing it. So he sat with his back to the audience, and we had to hire... We hired one man to sit there.
Oh,
and
it was Sam Payne.
It was Sam Payne.
That part, yes.
Sam Payne. And we hired a, Dorothy hired a musician to play. And then, after we got going, the theater, somebody came to you and said, this is a union theater, and if you hire one musician, you have to hire a whole, was it six?
I've forgotten.
Yeah, six, yes. I think it was. And so for every Monday night to Saturday night and Wednesday afternoon, we had to pay for six musicians and used one.
Oh. And the sad thing is that I tried out Sam Payne, because the question was, could he keep a tune?
Yes.
I took him out to the house on McDonald Street, and I played, struck a chord, and I said, now sing God Save the King. Well, of course, if you have a little bit of ear,
he sang it to perfection. There was no problem whatever. But then he'd sung God Save the King or the Queen since he was a baby. I thought he was all right, but I had much, well, we worked hard.
Yes, I think it was quite towards the end, getting near the deadline, that you hired.
Oh, I had to, help. Yes,
and then
yes,
you didn't have time to learn about the six other musicians you had to hire.
May I speak about Giggles? This is a Christmas play again. It's the poor, what helps the poor? Do you remember that, Lee? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that? Well, it's the scene, as I remember it, I think this is the play, is Awake. And it's a working class family, poor working class family, but they've come back after the funeral, and they're getting together with the family, and they're having beer. And one of these young men, who was playing an older man, a friend of the family, they were all supposed to be in their 30s, was the son of a clergyman in Vancouver. I can't think of his name. I like to think of that because I think sons of clergymen are often characters and a bit in revolt at times. Well, they sit around the table, a round table, they have bread and butter and beer. Suddenly, I could see the cast, and I'd forgotten who directed the play, Dr. Clark. I don't think Freddie directed it, I'd forgotten who. I could see the cast going, like this, like that.
Really?
It was ginger beer that they were drinking.
Ginger beer.
But this one lad had taken every one of those bottles and had shaken it until it was nothing but gas.
Oh,
and he didn't tell the rest of the cast, and they were drinking down this stuff, and of course the gas kept coming back.
Dear.
Oh, dear. I never shall forget that.
Mildred, you mentioned the Players Club of London. Now, how did that start? I played in various things in that, and it was terrific fun.
You won it for a lifetime?
No, I was with Bill Buckingham and Candlelight.
I think
Freddie. Oh, Candlelight.
Yes.
But
who?
Rock. Dave Rock.
We started
in Freddie.
Well, 19...
Rock was Freddie. No, but Freddie, who started the alumni?
It was started in 1930.
I've forgotten who directed the play.
Were you in Dr. Knock?
Dr.
Knopf was the first one.
Was it?
That was Dave Brock.
He did it too.
Was that Dave Brock?
I think Dave Brock.
Yes.
And
Bill Buckingham. Oh.
Bill Buckingham was in it because in Candlelight.
Well, that Candlelight was
at
the Little Bill, wasn't it?
No, it was at the University.
Was it?
Yes.
The Players Club alumni.
Yeah, the alumni. Yes. And then there was another play, an Australian one. I can't remember the name of it. And there was a Dorothy Fowler.
Oh, yes.
Oh, Dorothy McKelvey.
She was in it, and she wanted to go to Seattle to something the week before the show was going on. And I keep forgetting who directed it. And he said, no, you can't go.
I did.
Because... was it you directed...
Personal appearance of Dorothy McKelvey, yes.
Was that the Australian play...
No.
Well, she was a man. She did go to Seattle, and she came back with a roaring cold. Who was in bed 2 days before the thing was to open. Well, Nagus Harker took on the part, and in 2 days she was lettered perfect.
Oh well,
and it went on.
Yes, I was in that, but it was Lilies of the Field, but it wasn't. There was an Australian couple in it, with that lovely scene with the mother and daughter from Australia coming to board with these two British ladies so and so.
I can't remember. I was the big fat Australian woman that came.
And
in those days, I actually wore padding under my clothes to be like this. And my husband did not care for it, and that was it.
And the lovely scene of the daughter who comes in with the muff and breaks a piece of a little statuette and puts it in the muff and then keeps on talking about something she has hidden inside. She knows this way. It was really quite funny.
All I remember is Nagger's absolute marvelous.
That was because McKelvey wouldn't learn her lines. And Freddie got furious with her because she wouldn't learn her lines. Mm-hmm. And Nagus took over.
Jack, you forgot a story. You were a rugby player.
I played rugby, yes.
Well, tell your story.
Oh, well, that, oh, you
I remember, Freddie called me one day. I was supposed to, the spring play started on Monday.
Which one was it, do you remember?
Hmm?
Was it Mr. Pym or?
Well, I forget the play. I think it was Mr. Pym. But anyway, yes, it was Mr. Pym. I was playing rugby on Saturday. And Freddie said, you can't play rugby on Saturday because we're playing at the Avenue, starting our show on Monday. And, oh, I said, I can play rugby. You don't worry, I won't get hurt. And so I said, no, I'm going to play rugby. And I went back to class, and a little later I got a call from President Klink. And I went to his office to see him, and he said, my boy, Professor Wood, tells me that you're playing rugby on Saturday and you're taking the leading part in the play on Monday. And I said, yes. He said, my boy, you cannot play rugby on Saturday. And I didn't. No, there was a certain amount of discipline on the players' class. Yes.
have to behave yourself.
I just want to into something here.
Interject,
thank you. Not interject, I want to add to the tape so that it may be on record that all of us concerned with the history of the university and the history of the Players Club in particular, the years we have mentioned today, are very, very grateful to Lorenda Daniels, without whom this would not have been possible.
Yes,
I think
indeed.
That should be on the tape and kept on the tape.
I'm sure you will.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now, may we have a drink?
Yes.
And now, don't put that on the tape.
I just want to say that over on the table by the window there are programs, Players Club programs, and many pictures, and you are now free to go and browse through them and look at them.
And your picture,
yes, and Bee's picture, too.
There's a point that was never cleared up when.